Thank you, Lee Skirl, registration 0899. May it persuade the court. There are two things about this case which I believe you should have found to be interesting and would have caused you to devote more attention and interest to it than perhaps would typically be the case. And I say that, first of all, because, frankly, if I were one of your law clerks, I probably would have had that been cautioned about continuously reminding the law clerks of the other judges that they were not dealing with a case that was based on a statute that came into existence before we were even a state. And there may be other such statutes, but frankly, I can't cite you to any. And I would have to believe that the fact that this statute was a law, that it was here before we were a state, is significant from an academic point of view. And of course, I also have a feeling that your clerks probably haven't really called this the Roberts v. Van Riper case. I think they probably have given it a nickname. It certainly deserves some type of special nickname, and I would imagine that it might be referred to as the Is It Okay to Shoot Trespassing Dogs case, or the They Shoot Dogs, Don't They case. And of course, it is this shooting of dogs element that is the second reason I believe this case has got your special interest. Now, in fact, I would not be surprised if it hasn't caused some personally interesting moments for some of you in your non-court lives, because I suspect that when you go home to your spouses and your children, and maybe your grandchildren, you sometimes give them some minimal information about the cases that you decide. And I can speculate that if you told them that one of your cases involved a question of whether it's okay to shoot dogs that aren't doing anything except trying to find their way home, that would evoke some interesting family reactions. But this isn't really an opportunity for you to make new law. What I'm asking you to do is to reaffirm the law that was made by our Supreme Court in 1940, and of course the Family v. People case. And you all know that Clarence Failing challenged the fact that he'd been prosecuted and convicted for shooting two dogs that were near cattle. And what our highest court clearly declared was that just being in the vicinity of cattle does not give rise to the legal right to shoot them. And they said that Failing had a right to shoot those dogs because they, in fact, were 10 or 15 feet away from cattle. The cattle had their heads down and the dogs were barking at them. So they were, in fact, worrying the livestock. And in making that decision, the Supreme Court did cite to a case in California, which in fact was the case where an individual had challenged the fact that his dogs had been shot, and the court ruled in that case that the dogs had to have actually been involved in the act of worrying, and that was what the court hung its hat on in the Failing decision when it gave the opinion, quote, if nothing further had occurred, the killing by Failing would not have been authorized.
So, counsel, can I interrupt you on that? If I understand your argument, you're saying that the Supreme Court in Failing looked at the language of the statute, which said dog found worrying, to give a snippet of it, and decided that in order to have the protection of the statute, you must find the dog in the act of worrying.
Yes.
And that you're saying that the Supreme Court got that conclusion from the language of the statute.
I'm saying that it did, but it also relied in its decision on, it makes reference to this California case, which is Johnson v. McConnell, which was 22 Pacific 219, which clearly held that just because these three dogs were running around in a field with sheep, and the owner of the sheep thought that the sheep were being worried by the dogs, that wasn't enough to justify shooting them.
Okay, but the Supreme Court was interpreting the state statute, right?
And yes.
So if the Supreme Court, didn't they find, therefore, that the language of the statute adequately conveys the point that in order for the statute to apply, the dog must be found in the act of worrying?
Right.
So, and wasn't the statute tracked identically in the jury instruction here? Use the same language of the statute, so why doesn't that convey adequately the point that you must find the dog in the act?
Because the statute leaves it ambiguous as to what found means.
But did the Supreme Court find it ambiguous in Failing?
The facts in Failing weren't ambiguous at all. There was no question that these dogs were barking at the cattle. Now, there's no evidence in this case, the Roberts case, that these dogs were barking at all. There is an inference that maybe one dog barked twice. And this is an important point, because that one or two barks, and it was testified by Van Riper to be two barks, occurred when Van Riper was still in his shed area about to get on his utility vehicle to drive down towards his corral to see if something was going on. There's no evidence that those dogs were ever seen barking at his cattle. And in fact, the answer brief blatantly misrepresents that fact. There's nothing in the record to establish those dogs were barking at the cattle. And in fact, there's nothing to establish that the two barks that Van Riper heard weren't from his own dog. But in terms of what the court said in Failing, it said, look, if Failing, after running back or driving back or riding back to his house and coming back with his rifle, had found nothing further. In other words, if the dogs were no longer chasing or barking at the cattle, court said that the killing would not have been authorized. Now, that's the same thing as saying they have to be in the act of doing the worrying to be shot.
Can I interrupt you for a second? I want to ask you about the verdict forms in this case. I've looked at the verdict forms in this case, and they seem to suggest, if not state explicitly, that the jury was to find for defendant if the jury found that the plaintiff failed to establish the elements of the claims, including that whether the defendant acted willfully and wantonly or caused damage. Now, the jury seemed to find both, that the plaintiff failed to prove the elements of its crime, I mean of the claim, I'm sorry, and that the defendant proved the affirmative defense. But wasn't the jury's finding that the plaintiff failed to prove the elements of the claim enough to sustain the verdict in favor of the defendant, regardless of the affirmative defense?
In my opinion, no, because the jury didn't have any basis to even think about whether or not there had been a malicious killing, unless they decided that there wasn't justification for it. If they decided that there was justification, then they could have gone on to whether it was actually malicious. But they decided that there wasn't anything wrong with shooting the dog, so why worry about whether or not it was malicious or anything else?
Well, that's not what the jury was instructed. The instruction number 11 says, for plaintiffs to recover on their claim of willful and wanton conduct, the jury must find that plaintiffs had damages, defendant's conduct was willful and wanton, and defendant's willful and wanton conduct caused plaintiff's damages. And four, defendant acted without the affirmative defense set forth in instruction number 18. And then it says, if you find that any one or more of the first three statements has not been proved, or that the defendant has proved the affirmative defense, your foreperson shall complete special verdict form A1. Following up on my colleague's comment, it does seem as though the jury could have found that the elements of the tort had not been proved without referring whatsoever to the affirmative defense.
But in fact, The language you just read makes reference to the affirmative defense twice. And the first time it makes reference to it, the jury easily could have decided it has to be an affirmative defense that believe is not available. I see my time is running out here.
You have about 4 minutes and 50 seconds. You can feel free to answer Judge Graham's question.
Well, first of all, there wasn't ever any question about this jury verdict being something that was misunderstood. The only issue was whether or not the shooting was justified because of the affirmative defense. And if, in fact, they thought that the affirmative defense was valid, they didn't have to decide whether or not it was willful and wanton. And that's the whole point.
But in fact, the verdict form shows that they did decide that it was not willful and wanton, the conduct.
But the verdict form makes reference to the affirmative defense. There isn't anything in that verdict form that allows them to decide willful and wanton without reference to the affirmative defense.
It says that it presents the jury the alternative that they could either find the elements have not been met, or they could find the affirmative defense has been proved. They don't have to find both.
But read the first part of it again. Doesn't it say without the affirmative defense, and then it goes on to say either or?
I don't think that's what it says, but we'll look at it to make sure we're right.
Well, obviously, it wasn't something that I was prepared to discuss this morning, but I can tell you that the whole point is, if this jury had been told that, in fact, that they had to find that the affirmative offense was based upon the dogs actually being in the act of worrying, this would have been a different result. And I can tell you that because we talked to the jury afterwards.
Well, I noticed that we don't have any of the jury, the closing arguments to the jury in the record. So how do we know how it was argued to the jury?
Well, it isn't really an issue. When you look at the facts are uncontested. The dogs weren't anywhere near the cattle when they were shot. They were running away from the cattle when they were shot. That's an uncontested fact. So what difference does
it? I'm not sure how we know it's uncontested facts because we don't have all the trial testimony, do we?
Well, you
in the record.
Well, you've got the testimony of the shooter who admits that the dogs were running away, and nobody else said that they weren't.
Well, that's the part. We don't have the rest of the records in order to confirm what others might have testified.
Well, you know, when you're talking about getting records prepared, you're talking about an expense. And if the issue was whether or not the dogs were worrying the cattle, and the only person who was there was the shooter, and he says what he said, there wasn't ever anybody else that would have made any difference.
Well, according to the appellee's brief, he testified, and I guess you say this is not true. According to the appellee's brief, he testified that he heard the dogs barking in the corral, and the cows and calves inside the corral were quite agitated.
Yeah,
sounds like it meets the definition of worrying. I think your position is there's no such testimony.
That's exactly my position.
But you're not appealing here on the grounds of lack of sufficient evidence. You're only appealing on the affirmative defense instruction, right?
Well, the issue also was there should have been a directed verdict. So I mean judge notwithstanding verdict, that talks about sufficient evidence. But the evidence in the record is that there were two barks heard, and not that they were barking in the corral. In fact, the evidence at page R516 is the dogs were not even among the cattle. And if you want to focus on exactly where the bark testimony was, I mentioned that in my reply brief, and I was trying to find it again for you right here, but it's clear that here it is. It's at R434. He says, I heard a couple of barks from a dog. And then the question asked by his counsel was, could you tell the relative location of where he makes it sound like it was plural, dogs were barking, when the only evidence was I heard a couple of barks from a dog? And he says, yeah, corral area. So he never saw the dogs barking. He never saw even a single dog barking. And when he got there, the dogs weren't in the corral. They were out of the corral. And he assumed they had been in it. but they hadn't done anything to the cattle, and they were running away. So in terms of the whole problem for the jury was that they were allowed to decide what found meant without having any direction as to what the failing court said it meant.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Schwinn. Oh,
can I just ask you, who prepared the jury instructions that were given here?
I can't remember. I think it was a combination effort that involved several different efforts, several different attempts.
Is there any objection to instruction number 11, instruction number 18, or instruction number 12?
Instruction number 18 was objected to, all right, by me, and I cite in my brief exactly where my objection to that was. I wanted instruction number 29, so I objected fairly strenuously to 18. In fact, it's in what I'm calling the supplemental record because it didn't get designated properly by the clerk's office in Fremont County, and that's a separate story, but I can tell you that the discussion covers numerous pages, and it starts page two, where I'm talking about plaintiff's number 29, and it goes on, and...
So your position is you did object to instruction number 18, correct? We can look for it in the record.
I can understand why you might have trouble finding it, because like I say, it's in the supplemental transcript that I had to get. But it's there.
Okay, we'll find it. Thank you very much for your arguments, Mr. Sternall.
All right, thank you.
Now I hear from the happily.
Your Honor, my name is Roger Larson, attorney registration number 8362. I represent the appellee. The first issue I'm going to address is in response to the question about were there objections to verdict forms 11, 12, and 18, and the answer is there were no objections to 11 or 12, but there was objection to 18. It is in the supplemental record that he objected to that. He tendered another proposed jury instruction that did not track the statute and include language which was specifically excluded by the statute. So I think there is an additional problem there.
As Judge Graham pointed out, instruction number 11 told the jury they have to first consider willful and wanton conduct. Special verdict form A1 asked them, was the conduct of the defendant willful and wanton? They answered no. Having answered that, or was this willful and wanton conduct the cause of injuries? They answered no. Having answered one of those two questions, why do they even go to the affirmative defense? But why were the instructions set up that way? They haven't even allowed them to.
I will tell you that, in my opinion, the instructions were a bit of a mess to begin with. And so let's just talk about that trial process. There was a pretrial order that said that the plaintiff was to provide jury instructions some 20 or 30 days in advance of trial. That was not done. So there were no jury instructions prepared at the conclusion of the evidence. So there was approximately a day and a half where jury instructions were developed by the court and two counsel attempting to try and do this, frankly, what I would describe as last minute, as opposed to an orderly process of preparing those instructions. There were instructions that I had prepared as defense counsel that dealt specifically with the language of the statute, which is an instruction that I did, in fact, tender. With respect to that, so there may have been some confusion there. You can certainly have the issue of whether or not the behavior, while not justified, did not qualify as willful and wanton, and I believe that's why the issue of justification could come up, and they could find that the behavior was willful and wanton, meaning a deliberate act, the shooting at the dogs, but yet then find that even though it was willful and wanton, it was still justified And that's what I believe that the statute and the crux of this case is all about.
But given the actual jury instructions, which says that if they fail to find willful wanton conduct or any other element of the claim, they should return a verdict for defendant, does it matter what their finding was as to the affirmative defense?
The answer would be no. It wouldn't. That would be dispositive, and so we don't even get to the affirmative defense here. And they raised the issue with respect to a directed verdict, notwithstanding, and so we can go into that discussion. But frankly, I think it was, if you don't find it's willful and wanton, you lose. If you find that it's willful and wanton, you still have the issue of was it justified, and so then the jury could answer that question separately. The fact that they found not willful and wanton is in fact dispositive. You haven't met the initial threshold to even get to the issue of justification. So and then with respect to the statute as it relates to found worrying cattle, you didn't get the entire transcript of the testimony. Evelyn Smith testified that she saw the dogs frolicking outside the corral of the property. She also testified that she did call the defendant and spoke with the defendant's wife about the dogs. The defendant's wife testified that that Evelyn called and said there were two dogs bothering the cattle. She went and informed her husband. It took approximately 5 minutes before the husband got on his ATV. After he got on the ATV, he goes around the corral area. Now, what's important here factually is that there are only two cows and two calves in this corral. Both of those calves were less than a week old. Down further on the property, this 30-acre property, directly in the direction that was presented at trial, was yet a third cow that had given birth that morning to yet another calf. So when Mr. Van Riper went around the property and went around the corral, he heard the dogs barking, he saw that his cattle were agitated, and I think you have to take a look in terms of the summary judgment and facts of this case and say you can draw reasonable inferences. And so when he saw those dogs exiting the corral and headed towards that third cow calf, that birthing area that had been used by that cow with respect to these dogs, he had been sufficiently found the animals worrying cattle. They had barked at it, the cows were agitated, it was immediate in time to that. The dogs were still headed in the direction of yet another cow and calf, and that gave him the right to make the decision to fire at the dogs. Fired two shots. There was undisputed testimony. Fired two shots at that time. That's frankly undisputed testimony that after the dogs circled around the property and went down the ditch, he thinks he knows that he shot a third time, but doesn't believe that he hit either of the dogs.
Can I ask you a question about that third shot? Do you think that third shot would be justified under the statute and under your view of the statute?
Well, I think that you're entitled to finish what you started there, and that wounding the animal is maybe not sufficient in that particular circumstance, and that you are being more sensitive by taking and dispatching the dog, if you're capable of safely doing that, than leaving a wounded animal out running beyond the property lines to who knows where. And so the answer to that is I don't honestly know. That is not what I focused on during the trial. I don't think that's what was focused on at that point. At that point, he had already testified that he thought that he had already hit both of the dogs with the first two shots. He described the distance that was involved as aiming the background behind the dogs to make sure that it was safe to do that, because he didn't want to hit his animals, he didn't want to aim at anybody's home or in a place where the bullets themselves might escape his property boundary. And that ditch was just part of that process in the course of just a couple of minutes. And so when we talk about found worrying cattle, then the question is, do we put a time limit on it? Do we require injury? Do we require that we psychoanalyze the behavior of dogs? And I would suggest to you that that's not what the statute really addresses. there is a time limit. I don't know exactly what that time limit is. Failing is dicta with respect to, well, if they really aren't near the dogs and they aren't, I mean, aren't really near the cattle and they aren't doing anything that is threatening those cattle at that point, it's tough to argue that there's justification. But this was not remote in time. It was not remote in terms of the events. It was part of that episode that occurred all in a very, very short period of time. The cows were in, and the two cows and calves were in a very confined space in the corral along with those dogs. They were clearly agitated. He was clear that that's what had happened. And so the instruction was appropriate. The intended instruction talks about injuries to animals and his proposed jury instruction, and that clearly is not required by statute. And while I do think it is interesting that this statute was adopted prior when we were still a territory, I think it recognizes, and we can continue to recognize, that ranchers have an economic interest in their product, their cattle, and they're entitled to protect that economic interest. And that economic interest allows them to make some decisions with respect to dogs in particular, because we have a long-standing history of saying, if you're a dog owner, you have to control your dog. We had, and the jury was instructed, that we had a county resolution that dogs couldn't be running at large, that they had to be contained by a leash when outside a boundary fence, that they could be kept in their backyard. And so we have had a long history in this state of saying, well, we approve of dog owners, but you have to be in charge of your dogs. And when that doesn't happen, we have a statute that says if your dogs are misbehaving towards the economic interests of another, in this particular case, the cattle, that it is just inappropriate to say that we're going to add conditions before they can protect that economic interest, other than we're not going to let them do it willy-nilly just because they're on the property. They have to be found.
Mr. Larson, can I ask you about the plaintiff's tendered instruction that you think was inappropriate? It had the phrase, the dog must be found in the act of running, worrying, etc. Do you think that the facts of the case would not satisfy that instruction? Do you think the dogs were not found in the act of?
I think they were found in the act of. I think you.
Well, then why did you object to the instruction then?
Well, because it also put in language there about injuring. And injuring has never played any role, and I didn't want the jury to get confused that somehow you had to show that the animals that you were protecting, the cattle that you were protecting, had to be injured in some way in order to be avail yourself of the ability to use the statute.
And so just to be clear, if we excise the part about injuring, and we just had the dog found to be in the act of, you would be fine with that instruction. And your view that adequately states the statute?
Well, I think so. I've looked at this because I think found has to be defined as an event or series of events. I don't think you can say, gee, the dog's 30 feet away and barking at a cow with a head down, but if they're circling the cattle and the cattle are confused, that means you can't act. Or if as you're coming up to the dog decides to go away from you, does that mean that they have abandoned? Unlike in the criminal analogies don't really work. They fail fairly quickly in the analysis. But there has to be some form of clear understanding that the dogs are abandoning their effort to worry the cattle by either. I mean, they have to show some clear indication, and I don't think that the evidence in this case supports a finding, nor would I believe the trial judge have found that was unambiguous, because those dogs were headed directly at the birthing area and that newborn calf, the calf that had been born approximately 9 a.m. that morning. This was some 4 hours after the birth of that calf, so 4 or 5 hours. And so I think it's very difficult when you are dealing with dogs to necessarily have a correct assumption as to what dogs are doing. And so I think that's why you have to give some latitude as to whether they're still found worrying cattle. by looking at the behavior of the dogs and the fact that he had come around using an ATV around the corral, and they're heading out that exit but directly at another cow-calf, makes it a problem.
I want to object to his continued representation that the dogs were heading towards another cow and calf. He's overlooking the evidence.
Okay, we'll look at the record and we'll make our own decision, but I appreciate your point. Please continue.
Sorry. So I would suggest that the court was both correct in denying the judgment, notwithstanding the verdict, because I believe the evidence was overwhelming that they had in fact done that correctly, and the facts would support that. I would suggest that given precise definitions that follow and track the statute precisely is not an error, that the jury then took a look at the facts that were presented and the reasonable inferences. Remember, we do allow jurors to make reasonable inferences as to the behavior, that when you look at that, it's clearly that this was not a judgment that was an error, and my client was vindicated at the trial level and should be vindicated on appeal.
Thank you, Mr. Morrison. Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments.